WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a man who knows how to write hits, playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon. His many successes include The Odd Couple, Plaza Suite, Brighton Beach Memoirs, The Goodbye Girl, and The Sunshine Boys. He's just written a memoir called Rewrites. Also today, the future of the book. Does the book have a future in this era of the internet and the CD-ROM? We'll talk with linguist and Fresh Air commentator Jeffrey Nunberg, who's just edited a book on the subject. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has sacked his ambitious security chief Alexander Lebed a day after the Interior Minister accused the former general of plotting to seize power. Yeltsin announced the firing in a national television appearance. NPR's Andy Bowers has more from Moscow.
President Yeltsin has basically fired Alexander Lebed. Yeltsin went on TV tonight from the sanatorium where he's preparing for heart surgery. He said that Lebed had tried to resign a few weeks ago, but at the time Yeltsin had hoped that that Lebed would, quote, learn to work with all the state organizations and leaders. However, he said that apparently Lebed has not learned to do this, and so he accepted the resignation this evening.
NPR's Andy Bowers reporting from Moscow. After his ouster, Lebed told reporters that he will take a vacation and then completely and fully engage in politics. Defense Secretary William Perry is in Moscow. He urged Russian lawmakers today to approve the START II arms reduction treaty, banning all land-based multiple warhead nuclear missiles. But some of the legislators said they aren't comfortable with the idea of giving up strategic missiles, and others said they don't trust the United States now because of talk about including former Warsaw Pact nations in NATO. The U.S. Senate has already ratified the START II treaty. Both President Clinton and GOP nominee Bob Dole have events planned in Southern California today as they try to capitalize on their showings in last night's final presidential debate. Dole's running mate Jack Kemp says polls in the state are volatile, and he thinks the GOP ticket does have a chance to capture California's 54 electoral votes. Following last night's debate, Dole spoke to an invited audience at a rally in downtown San Diego. Nancy Greenlees, member station KPBS, reports.
The crowd chanted his name and confetti flew again for Bob Dole at the San Diego Convention Center.
We are going to cut your taxes. The liberal Clinton administration, we can't afford a tax cut. They can't afford anything, but they're going to get the tax cut if he leaves his change of address. We'll send him the check starting January 7, 20th, 1997.
Dole called for another debate against President Clinton, this one about the economy. Thousands of Democrats attended a rally for President Clinton in Balboa Park. Both candidates are campaigning in Southern California today. For National Public Radio, I'm Nancy Greenlees in San Diego.
The latest government statistics point to slower growth in the economy with no sign of a resurgence of inflation. The Commerce Department says housing starts fell 6% last month, and the Federal Reserve says industrial production edged up just 0.2% in September. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 24 points at 6,045 in heavy trading. On the over-the-counter market, the Nasdaq Composite Index is down a fraction. This is NPR News. An estimated 1.6 million state workers in France staged a one-day strike today to protest the government austerity moves that have included a wage freeze and job cuts. French Prime Minister Alain Juppé is trying to trim the country's deficit in time for the planned start of a single European Union currency in 1999. But his popularity is sagging as the country's unemployment rate rises. Israeli and Palestinian negotiators have resumed talks in the Egyptian Red Sea resort of Taba, and Israeli officials say they're on the verge of reaching an agreement. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israel Radio today reported that only one issue remains to be solved before an agreement on the long-delayed Israeli troop withdrawal from the West Bank town of Hebron can be announced. That issue is buffer zones that Israel is demanding between areas where Palestinian police will be deployed and places where 450 Jewish settlers live. Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat yesterday attacked Israel's proposal, saying Israel wants to divide Hebron into two cities, one Jewish and one Arab, and accusing Israel of racism. A senior aide to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accused Arafat of propagating a big lie. Yet Israeli analysts say they remain confident an agreement can be reached in the next few days on the outstanding issues. Jewish settlers in Hebron say that if Israeli soldiers pull out of even part of the town, they will form militias to protect themselves. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
There's no immediate danger to Florida from Hurricane Lily, but forecasters say the state could still feel the effects of the storm. Lily now about 230 miles south of Cuba and moving north-northeast. Several star football players at a suburban high school in Salt Lake City have been charged with committing a string of armed robberies. Police say the students talked openly about their alleged exploits to teammates. The group includes two sons of police officers. They're connected to 22 armed robberies in the region. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News. In Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Moro, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon has made a lot of people laugh. He started his career in the early days of television, writing for Sid Caesar's show, Phil Silver's Sergeant Bilko, and The Gary Moore Show, but his real ambition was to write plays. He succeeded. His hits include Come Blow Your Horn, Barefoot in the Park, Plaza Suite, Prisoner of Second Avenue, The Sunshine Boys, The Goodbye Girl, California Suite, Brighton Beach Memoirs, Biloxi Blues, and Laughter on the 23rd Floor. He also wrote the book for the musicals Sweet Charity and Promises, Promises. Simon adapted many of his plays into successful films. The popular movie and TV series The Odd Couple were adapted from his hit play. The movie starred Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon as two divorced men sharing an apartment, having the same kinds of problems with each other they used to have with their wives.
Oscar, what is it? Is it the cooking or the cleaning, the crying?
I'll tell you exactly what it is. It's the cooking, the cleaning, the crying. It's the talking in your sleep. It's those moose calls that open your ears at 2 o'clock in the morning. Can't take it anymore, Felix. I'm cracking up. Everything you do irritates me. And when you're not here, the things I know you're going to do when you come in irritate me. You leave me little notes on my pillow. Told you 158 times I cannot stand little notes on my pillow. We are all out of cornflakes, F.U. Took me 3 hours to figure out that F.U. was Felix Unger.
Neil Simon has just written a memoir titled Rewrites. I asked him how he developed his ear for writing dialogue.
I never thought about it much, but the only thing that came to me is that when I was a young boy, 5 and 6 and 7 years old, my parents would take me to visit their relatives, and for some reason, I think they thought that I was invisible because they never talked to me.
Right, or they talk about you even though you could hear?
I could hear, but they were talking family matters or gossip or whatever, and I just sat there, and once in a while, they'd give me a cookie or something, and I just listened. I wasn't terribly interested, but it stuck in my head, and what I managed to learn was the way they talked, the choice of words they made, what it was that they were interested in. And years later, without knowing it, when I started to write about these people, I was able to draw on my own memory from what happened in those days.
The first sketch that you wrote that was performed in front of an audience was for the Abraham and Strauss department store.
Right, yes. I was 15 years old.
Right, and this was what, their annual employee show?
Yes, a lot. Well, there was a producer we knew, and as in the book I tell that ultimately I worked with on the Jerry Lewis show, but this producer did what they called industrial shows, and he found these two young kids, one 8 years older than myself, my brother, Danny and Doc Simon, as we were called then. And we showed him some material we had written, and he says, I'd love you to write the show. Well, this was like going to Broadway, even though it was in Brooklyn in a department store. But it was the thrill of my life. And that night, hearing hearing our material, which was not jokes, which was a bit of a sketch that had some character, and it was mostly department store kind of comedy, and the audiences were easily affected by it. But that was the first step, and I think maybe the first time the bug bit me.
Early on in your career, your brother Danny was your writing partner. And he's what, about 8 years older?
Eight and a half years older, yes.
Yeah. And you write in your book that he was somewhere between your brother and your father. He was your mentor as well as your brother. And your father actually was in and out of the family. He left the family and came back, I think, about eight times.
Exactly, yes.
Was it strange to have him coming and going like that, not knowing exactly what his relationship to you was?
It was awful, because I felt my life was sort of on a yo-yo, to give my kind of example. My mother never knew when he was coming back, and the whole world lit up when he came back, because it meant not only that we'd not have to fear for the rent, because he didn't leave any money for us, we didn't have to worry about food, but I felt a solidity there with the family, and I felt happy for my mother. When he was gone, it was the most awful time, and I thought he was never coming back. And I'm sure a lot of my personality has been formed by that relationship, and it makes me somewhat insecure at times. And it's why I think I fell back on writing, possibly, as a way of being able to support and survive for myself.
I imagine your mother, when your father was gone, ended up very busy with earning money to take care of the family.
Yes, she was uneducated. Mm-hmm. She did not have a job, and she would do whatever she could to provide for us. She borrowed from her family, but what she eventually did, which was the hardest thing for us, was she took in two men to live in our house, two boarders, who took her bedroom, and she slept on the sofa in the living room. My brother and I had our own bedroom, and they were butchers, and they paid us mostly in meat and lamb chops. It was no fun sitting at the room in the kitchen eating with them.
Why not?
They were like strangers. They didn't talk to us. They were mostly foreigners. And I don't mean mostly foreign. They were foreign and spoke some English, but it was difficult, and it was not my father. And I felt I was living in not my house, but their house.
You know, the stereotype of the Jewish mother of your mother's generation was of the overly possessive, overly neurotic Jewish mother, right? I imagine your mother was much too busy.
She was.
To fit that stereotype at all.
No, I don't think she did fit that stereotype. She was very different. She was very loving and very encouraging in terms of my brother and I doing the writing. My brother, foolishly, I think, would read the monologues that we would write at first to my mother, and she would just laugh all the way through. And my brother said, "Do you understand what they mean?" And she said, "No, I don't." And he said, "Well, why are you laughing?" She says, "Well, it pleases me to please you." I mean, it was such a wonderful thing for her to do. It didn't encourage us as writers, but it encouraged us that we had a terrific mother.
Neil Simon is my guest. He has a new memoir called Rewrites. You write that your brother got you a whore shortly after your 21st birthday, and that was your sexual initiation.
Yes, it was.
Looking back, was that a good way to become initiated?
I don't know if it was a good way. It was the only way. I mean, if he left it to me, I'd be 54 before it happened. I'm sure glad it did happen. But it did change me. I mean, you have to get through that moment, because it was the most fearful moment of my life. And I don't know why it is, looking back. I mean, that you don't expect this woman to think that you should be expert at what you're doing, or that this is going to be a very personal affair and that we should like each other. It's really a cash and carry business, and you just do it. But I felt so much better having done it, and that I would never have to do it that way again, which I never did.
There's a similar but different scene in Biloxi Blues, where the character there also has his first experience with a prostitute, but that's on an army base, so it's...
Yeah, but the origin of that scene in that film was exactly what happened to me. I mean, it was with a prostitute.
Yeah.
It was his fellow friends bringing him there, but he was... There was a line in it that summed it up, because I felt the same way when it happened to me. He said, I'm not expecting this to be a pleasurable experience. I just want to get through it.
You have a funny description there about how you initially lie down the bed. in a position and with an expression on your face as if you were going to be talking about the latest art film.
I know. I was trying to be very suave. Why I was trying to impress this woman who was going to have like seven of those affairs that night, I don't know, but that's the way I was. I was very naive, and very naive for many, many years to come.
Neil Simon is my guest. He has a new memoir called Rewrites. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Neil Simon, he has a new book called Rewrites that follows his life through the plays that he wrote. You moved to Los Angeles early in your career to write for television.
No, I think that's misinterpreted in the book because I saw someone else say that. I didn't really move there. I went there when I was married to my first wife, Joan, and we had our first child who was 6 months old. And I went out there just to write the Jerry Lewis show. We were going back. My wife never wanted to go to California, nor did I.
Well, there's a very funny story I want you to tell, and that's like shortly after you move in, Ward Bond knocks on your door.
Well,
Ward Bond, who was in so many Westerns and was later the wagon master on Wagon Train
wagon
on television.
Train, yes. Well, when I wrote that, I assumed that no one in this country would know who Ward Bond is. I mean, there are a lot of people under the age of 50 or 40 even who would even remember from Wagon Train. But we rented a house on a street called Coldwater Canyon, and there was a knock on the door, and I opened it up, and there is Ward Bond, looking like he did in the movies, and saying, "Hi, my name is Ward Bond, sir, and I'd like to tell you about the dry leaves around your grounds here. These catch fire very easily." And I thought it was interesting that he had to tell me who he was, and he also added the name sir to me when I was 30 years old, and this was one of the most famous stars, at least in the country. So, and he said, you know, once the Santa Ana winds start blowing, you know, this place can catch fire like a tinderbox. Well, and I said to him, was the Santa Ana the one who killed everybody at the Alamo, or is that the philosopher? I don't think he knew what I was talking about.
Yeah, and Ward Bond was your neighborhood representative for fire
control.
For
the fire safety, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Well, it must have been such a disorienting experience to have your fire rep knocking at your door.
Well, I realized that this was what California and Hollywood was about, that movie stars lived all around you, and they were your neighbors. You never thought you would ever see them in your life. Even though I had written for a number of pretty famous people up until then, still living the life in Hollywood, which is, especially at that time, which is close to 30 years ago, was a very bizarre place because the houses didn't seem to make sense. There wasn't a consistency in the construction or in the architecture of the houses. There would be gingerbread houses. They would look like they came from Spain, from Switzerland, from God knows where, from everywhere. And so it was its own unique kind of place, which I didn't find very charming. And I didn't like the weather that much. It was sunny all the time.
Why did you want to write plays on Broadway, knowing that you would be reaching a much larger audience writing for television?
Well, I didn't care about the size of the audience. I cared about the quality of what I was writing, and the personal issue was the main thing, that I'd be writing from inside of me. I was telling my story. I thought Come Blow Your Horn was about just a small, middle-class Jewish New York family. But the play got a widespread attention. It's played in Europe. It was made into a film. So my ambition, I think, ever since I was about 18 or 19, I think I was much younger than that when I saw my first play, but I was bitten by that also, very attracted to it. Movies seemed like glamour to me, but the theater sounded like writing.
You say that you have always followed the advice of Max Gordon, who said, think of characters, not stories or plots. Why is that good advice?
Because that's what a play is about. There are very few plays that are about a plot. Movies are made about plots. Television shows are about plots. If you go to a movie studio today and bring a script and they start to read it and they'll say, oh, I see, this is character-driven, isn't it? Which is a negative to them. I grew up reading many, many books. I got pulled into the stories by the characters, as I did with the early films that I saw, the characters that Humphrey Bogart played, or even a Leslie Howard, or any of the great actors. That's what I was attracted to.
Let me ask you about creating two of your most famous characters, Felix and Oscar, the odd couple.
Yes.
How did you come up with those characters?
Well, I just watched it in real life. It was my brother, Danny, and a friend of his named Roy Gerber, both of whom moved in together in the same apartment because they recently were divorced. And they wanted to cut down on their expenses so they could help pay their alimony. And in their social life, rather than going out on a double date somewhere and spending a lot of money on the dinner, my brother Danny decided to cook. And Roy was kind of a, you know, things came and go very easily for him. So he would just say to the girls, come up for dinner, come, you know, 6:30, 7, 7:30, whenever you're ready. Well, to Danny, that was anathema. I mean, he was, he cooked the pot roast that night. He wanted them there at 7:30. And I watched this one night. I came up to Danny's apartment and Roy's apartment. I saw this taking place as they were getting prepared for this dinner. I was going to leave before the dinner happened. And it was hilarious to me. And I said, Danny, this is a great movie, a great play, something. You must write it, because Danny was a writer too. But he never wrote by himself. And he started to write the play, but he took 3 months or so to write 10 pages and finally called me and he said, I can't do it. He says, I'm not a writer and I'm certainly not a playwright. He is a writer, of course, but he was not a playwright and he didn't know how to construct it. And he said, you take the play and you do it. And so I made a financial arrangement with him because it was his basic, it wasn't his idea to do it as a play, but it was his life, so I was taking a part of it. When I wrote the play in the beginning, I thought I was writing a very dark comedy. I didn't think it was going to be as funny as it was dark, because here was a man who was broken up with his wife that he loved dearly, and he had to leave his two children at home, and he was almost suicidal. Whereas Roy was another kind of character who was, I mean, the character that Roy was based on, the Oscar character, was a man who couldn't really keep his life going together, didn't know how to take care of his children's goldfish when they left. And so I thought I was writing, as I said, this grim comedy until I gave it to Bob Fosse, a good friend of mine who lived in the same building, to read. And he says, this is the funniest play I've ever read. And I said, you don't find it dark? And he said, no, not at all. So the author is not always sure about what impression he's going to leave when he writes this thing.
Now, how'd you feel about The Odd Couple when it became a TV series, where instead of like a constructed play every week, there was another little adventure or mishap to write
well,
around?
Well, I have to preface that by telling you the story, which you may have read in the book, that I had a business agent who thought he was doing me a favor by getting a deal made with Paramount Pictures, whereby they would buy this little company from me for $125,000, which seemed like an enormous amount of money, in which they got all of the TV and television rights to The Odd Couple. So I never saw a penny of any of The Odd Couple television series. So I could not watch that. I didn't watch that for 2 years, because when I saw that it was a hit, I saw that's my money going down their drain.
Right.
And I also lost all of the stage rights of Barefoot in the Park. Never made a penny on that play from the day it opened. And so so I looked at that as a very bad experience, and it was hard for me to watch the show until I finally did see it about 2 years after it was running, and I saw how good it was. It was really good. Didn't do me any good, but it's okay for them.
Oh, boy, what heartburn it must cause to feel that you almost don't want to see the success of your own work because you're not getting anything out of it.
I know. It was hard, but maybe just pushed me on to do other things. And I said, I've got to get on with this. I'm not going to sit and just gripe about it for the rest of my life. And I just went on to write other plays.
What was Broadway like when you first got there?
It was great. There were, I would say, a minimum of 20 plays on Broadway. I think today you'd be lucky to find 5 plays on Broadway. When I say a minimum, I think maybe there'd be 30. And if you would count the amount of plays that were there during the entire season, the plays that failed and moved on or had run its run from the year before, so there could be 40 plays on Broadway. Actors were always acting. Once a play closed, they auditioned for another play. And so it was not a place that I felt I was not going to be able to break into. There was a long road to do it because I had to write a play and get get it past the producers. I showed the first play, Come Blow Your Horn, to many producers, about 10 or 12 of the best of them, David Merrick and Garson Kanin and some of the best-known people in the theater. They gave me wonderful tips about writing the plays, but they didn't want to put on a Come Blow Your Horn. They didn't think it was experienced enough, and so the only way I could save it was by going to summer stock to the Bucks County Playhouse in New Hope, Pennsylvania. We put it on there. It was sort of a success, but it wasn't there all the way through, and so the producers there said if I took 6 months and rewrote it and they liked the rewrite, they would put it on Broadway. But it was a glorious time on Broadway then, and I'm sorry to see it not the same way. It's still a very lucrative place. It's a very successful place now. There are many more musicals, and there probably always will be. But it doesn't stop me because I've written a new play for next year, and I'll go back to Broadway with it.
What's changed? What was once there that you miss now?
The accessibility of seeing the best actors in the business. There was Henry Fonda and any other number of wonderful actors who would come from Hollywood each year to do it. When the difference in salaries didn't seem to mean anything, but now an actor in one television series could make enough in that one series, if it ran 3 years, 5 years, 8 years, to last him his life. He never had to work again. We've lost all of those actors. Lost them from the theater. Very hard to get somebody who would come back and do a play. You do occasionally, but it's few and far between. So I kind of write ensemble plays now where I don't need stars for the most part. Once in a while, I do get them. Like I had Alan Alda, let's say, for Jake's Women. But the minute Alan left, we couldn't find a suitable replacement or someone with his name as big as Alan. And so the play had to close. I like the one I do something like Barefoot in the Park that could be an ensemble too because Robert Redford was unknown at the time. But I'm talking about the Brighton Beach Memoirs when I had all these young boys on the stage and young girls, and out of it came Matthew Broderick and a few other characters who did go on to better things or more lucrative things. But it has changed.
Neil Simon's new memoir is called Rewrites. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Well, here's a song from Sweet Charity, the hit musical that Neil Simon wrote the book for. This is Gwen Verdon singing If My Friends Could See Me Now.
If they could see me now, that little gang of mine. I'm eating fancy chow and drinking fancy wine. I'd like those Stumbo bums to see for a fact the kind of top drawer, first-rate chums I attract. All I can say is, wowee, look at where I am. Tonight I landed, pow, right in a pot of jam. What a setup, holy cow. They'd never believe it if my friends could see me now. If they could see me now, my little dusty group, traipsing around this million-dollar chicken coop. I'd hear those thrift shop cats say, brother, get her draped on a bedspread made from three.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our talk with Neil Simon. Also, is the book doomed in the era of the CD-ROM and the internet? We talk with linguist and Fresh Air commentator Jeff Nunberg, who's just edited a book on the future of the book. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Back with more of our interview with playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon. His many hits include Barefoot in the Park, The Odd Couple, Plaza Suite, Prisoner of Second Avenue, The Sunshine Boys, The Goodbye Girl, Brighton Beach Memoirs, and Laughter on the 23rd Floor. Neil Simon has just written a memoir called Rewrites. You write a little bit in your book about being in analysis, and you say that your first year of analysis was, in a sense, an attempt to introduce you to yourself, the two sides of you, one the writer and the other the person who doesn't write. Are these two sides of you at odds?
Well, they have been for years. They weren't always at odds. They were just different people. They were not the person that I was with my family, with my friends. The writer is a very solitary person who is, I guess in the worst sense, willing to pick the bones of somebody else's character and put it up there on the stage, even though I don't think I've ever hurt anybody by doing it, because no one ever came up to me and said, how dare you put this up there on the stage. As a matter of fact, when I put my father up on the stage and Come Blow Your Horn, he came to see it, and I was very fearful of what he was going to say. And I said, what'd you think, Dad? And he says, oh, I know men just like that. He never saw himself in it at all, which is what most people do. Sometimes people come up to me and they say, that was me you were writing about, wasn't it? And it wasn't at all anything that I was writing about. So about the two Neil Simons, yes. The writer was persistent. He just always wanted to write. The other person wanted to have more fun, more leisure time, more time with his family. And so they were at odds. But I find as time goes on, right about now, maybe as we're talking, that the two characters are becoming more wed to each other. I don't see the disparity in the two personalities anymore. It sounds like I'm a little psychotic, but I'm not, really.
Well, maybe that's because the two have lived together for so long, they've become more acclimated to each other.
I know. I'm my own odd couple.
That's a nice way of looking at it. Did analysis help?
Well, analysis, I think, helps in the long run. I never went for, like, long, long periods at a time. I would go from time to time when there was great trouble in my life, when my first wife died, when I had other personal problems. But after a while, I started to go because it was a way of learning about myself and about learning about other people, because the conversations were not only about this Neil Simon character. It was about how they are affected by other people in the world. And once you get into that subject, you start to talk about the other people in the world, and you realize that you do not live alone in this world. So it was very educational for me. I graduated, got a diploma. It was very nice.
Was it helpful for you as a writer to introspect out loud like that?
I think so. The one thing it helped me to do was open myself up to a complete stranger, because I went to different analysts during my life, and I never had any trouble doing it. I know people who would say, oh, I would never tell that to my analyst. And I said, what are you going for? I was never afraid that they were going to betray my privacy or that they were going to dig too deep. I was sometimes afraid that I was going to go someplace that was so dark and deep in myself that it might throw me. But it never did. I never found that place that was so awful. I just realized that I was human and I was subject to human experiences and troubles and travails and a lot of happiness. If anything, the annals may have taught me to try to enjoy my life so much. One of them said, "Neil, you don't enjoy your successes long enough." And I said, "Well, how you mean to play?" And she says, "Yes. I mean, you go around for about 3 or 4 days and say, this is great. And then you just go back to work and you forget about it." And I said, "Well, you have to tell me how long I'm supposed to enjoy myself. It's work to me. And I enjoy the work. So I'm enjoying the work more than I am the success."
You also had claustrophobia, right?
I did, yes. Strangely, it just went away. I don't know. I couldn't get on planes. I couldn't get on elevators. And
Didn't you live in an apartment building? Didn't you live in an apartment, like a high rise?
In New York?
Yeah.
Yes, but not while I had claustrophobia. I mean,
otherwise
I was growing
you'd be taking the stairs a lot.
Yes, when I was growing up in New York, we lived on the third floor, so I walked up there. When I did live in a building that had an elevator, if it had an elevator, man, then I was all right. Once the push buttons came in, I was getting kind of scared. But it just disappeared one day. I couldn't get on a plane without a drink or something like that, or a pill. That went away as well. I sometimes can get it. I don't like driving in a car where that's a two-door car and I have to sit in the back. And that it all has to do with control. It means I am at the whim of the person driving the car. If I say, "Stop the car, I want to get out," and he says, "No, I'm stuck back there." So I need control over my life, which is why I think one of the reasons I became a writer, because while I'm in that room, nobody can say, "No, that's not good, you can't do that."
I thought a kind of funny part of your book was, I guess it's the late 60s, early 70s, you were writing about the era of the so-called sexual revolution, and you were married, but you wanted in.
I wanted to be a part of this. Yeah, it wasn't the sexual revolution so much. I'd been married for 14 years, and I thought, I was looking at myself in a different way, and I said, "You got married fairly young. I had very, very few experiences, except in the Grimm Hotel, and I was not looking, I didn't want to go out cheating on my wife. I didn't want to have a very negative kind of a life, but I felt I was so shallow in my experiences, so needy to know what the underbelly of life was like. And so it was more of a mind experience of wanting to know other things without having the danger of going through them. And so I did have a talk with my wife, almost asking to get out of the marriage for a while. And she took it so casually because she knew I wasn't going anyplace. She knew me better than I did. And I kept saying, "Well, I think I'm going to leave." And she said, "Oh, that's okay. When do you want to go?" And I was shocked and amazed by her attitude. And I knew how much smarter she was than me and how much better she was than me. And when I reached the point when I felt that I already had my freedom because she had given it to me. And I said, "Never mind." And I never went anyplace.
My guest is playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon. He's just written a memoir called Rewrites. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Neil Simon is my guest. He has a new memoir called Rewrites. Your book ends with your first wife's death from cancer. And you explain in there that the doctor had told you that the cancer had metastasized.
Yes.
And that you didn't have long to live. But you and your doctor agreed it might be best not to let her know that.
Well, we did tell her that she did have, the doctor did tell her that she had cancer, but he told me he was going to tell her that we had nipped it in the bud, that it was caught and that she was going to get through this. And he said to me, "We have to give her hope." He says, "However, the time will come." He says, "Because I don't think she has more than a year and a half." He said, "She will tell you when it's the right time to talk about it." Only in the year and a half, she never did. whether she believed that she was going to get through it or whether she believed it was better to keep it to herself. She told me not to tell it to anyone except her mother, which was the only person, with the exception of two of my closest friends, that I needed to be able to talk to about anything else, just to go out, to go to a movie. I needed these two friends. But my children didn't know. And that was my greatest regret, that I never told the girls until the very end. My eldest daughter, Ellen, I did tell about a few weeks before it happened. My middle daughter, Nancy. When I say middle, I have another daughter now with my marriage, current marriage. Nancy didn't know until it was too late. And as I said at the very end of the book, that the greatest regret I had in my life was not being able to tell Nancy, not because for Joan's sake, but for Nancy's sake, because she always felt that she lost the 5 years that Ellen had, because Ellen was 5 years older, that Ellen had with her mother, Nancy did not have. But I was sort of, in a way, exonerated or rewarded when Nancy read the book just recently and told me that she felt so much better now knowing that the reason that her mother could not pay as much attention to her towards the end was because she was not able to.
She didn't know that till she read the book?
She knew it intellectually. She didn't know it psychologically. She never really dealt with it. So it was a cathartic experience for her. I mean, she loved her mother dearly and just didn't know what was going on. She was only 10 years old, where Ellen did understand. Ellen knew it even before I told her.
It's always, I think, a hard decision for people to make, how much information to give a loved one about their own illness. Do you have any regrets about not having told the complete truth to your wife when she was sick?
Well, I kept waiting for her to talk about it. I did see her talk about it in various other ways. We moved up to the country for a while, and Joan would talk to Nancy and say, talk about the trees and the flowers, how they would all be replenished and how they all stay in this world and one nurtures the other thing. And so in her own way, she was saying to Nancy that I will not be gone. Maybe my body will be gone, but the rest of me, the spirit of me, won't be gone. She didn't put it in those words, but Nancy sort of understood that without knowing what was actually going to come.
Your book ends with the death of your wife, Joan, in the 1970s. Do you plan a part two to your life story?
Yes. I intended to all along. This book was going to be a full-length biography, but I had reached around page 400 when I got to that, and there was at least another 400 pages to tell, and I didn't want to write an 800-page book on my life. And so when I gave the book to Simon & Schuster, and I said, do you mind if I ended this volume here? And they said, not at all. It's a perfect ending for the book, and we'll do another one when you get to it.
You have a theory that you write about in the book, that your mind doesn't know when you're writing that it's only fiction. Your mind thinks you're actually living through whatever you're putting on paper.
Yes.
What has led you to this conclusion?
Because my body goes through the pain that I am going through in the writing. I feel the tenseness if I'm writing a scene between, let's say, a husband and wife who are having a fractious marriage. Things are going wrong. There's a big argument. There's a confrontation. I feel the intensity in my body, and I don't think I'm acting that out. I truly feel it. I'm exhausted when I go home. Whereas if I write something that's a funnier scene, a lighter scene, a more loving, romantic scene, I don't feel that same tension. I feel a lightness about me. So I don't think that the mind differentiates about what's going on in real life or what's going on in the fiction you're writing.
So fiction really does take its toll on you physically.
It does, but it's been very rewarding for me. I don't think I would like to have been anything else in life but a writer, but I also don't think I could have been anything else.
Did you ever try?
Well, no, I was too busy writing.
Right. Well, Neil Simon, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Neil Simon's new memoir is called Rewrites. In this era of the internet and the CD-ROM, what is the future of the book? Does it even have a future? Linguist and Fresh Air commentator Jeff Nunberg has just edited a book of essays examining the question from lots of different angles. The book is called The Future of the Book. Jeff told me why he wanted to take on this subject.
Well, you know, I've been in these two communities for a long time now. On the one hand, I work with these very high-tech people who are at the cutting edge of the new technologies. And on the other hand, I'm involved with humanists and people who make traditional print dictionaries and so on and so forth. And so I listen to these two stories, and it's always seemed to me, listening to this, that this discussion of the future of the book has been dominated by these two extreme points of view. So you have these techno-visionaries on the one hand, and the technophobes on the other, and they're locked in this kind of cycle of codependence. So they're both saying the world is coming to an end, but, you know, one side is happy about it, and the other side is terrified of it. And it seemed to me there were more interesting things that could be said about the future of the book than simply this kind of banal discourse about the end of the book and so on.
So do you think books have a future?
Oh, yeah. I guess it depends, of course, what you mean by books. When people talk about books, if they mean simply bound printed volumes, then probably a lot of those will be converted to digital form very soon. I mean, the parts catalogs, the technical manuals, the phone directories, the regulations, and that comprise an enormous part of the printed material in the world now. And I saw somewhere the figure that the documentation that accompanies the Boeing 747 weighs more than the Boeing 747 does. And all of that can go digital. If on the other hand, we are talking about the books that do the cultural heavy lifting, the fiction, the criticism, the history, and so on and so forth, I think that will probably remain in print form for quite a long time.
Why? What can those books do in book form that they can't do in electronic form?
One thing that people tend to think about when they talk about this contrast is the contrast between the page and the screen. Yanni Prue made this remark that people aren't going to ever read novels on those twitchy little screens. And my sense, and the sense of a lot of people who work with the technology, is that the limitations of the screens will be overcome very shortly. You can right now go and see these 6 million pixel amorphous silicon displays that are really the equivalent of an offset page, the sort of thing you see in a magazine. But the book has other virtues that we tend to think about less, I think. There's first the fact that the book is a permanent form that lives out in the world. I was thinking about the fact that people used to burn books. You don't burn a piece of software or something. And the reason, I think, isn't just that it would be very hard to gather all those pieces of software together and burn them, because after all, nobody really could ever burn all the copies of a book either, but that a book has a public presence. You can burn it. It's like tearing down a monument in a public space. And web documents and digital documents don't have that sense. Another is just the way the book fits into your body. You put your hands around a book, you read in a book, you measure where you are in the book according to the shrinking distance between your thumb and your forefinger. So the book has a lot of virtues that we perhaps tend to overlook. But I should also say that it isn't really a question of either or, of choosing the book or choosing a digital representation. I have on my workstation a copy of the dictionary, of which I'm a usage editor. It's much easier to consult electronically than in the print version. I go right to the word and so on. But sometimes you want to pick up a large print dictionary, weighs about 7 pounds, and wave it in the air or thump it down on the desk. And for that, the physical book is the ideal way to go. So my sense is that we'll have both. We'll have the digital representations for consulting and searching and so on, and we'll have the books for sustained reading.
There are many things that an electronic book can do, like a CD-ROM or a book online, that a print book that's bound between two covers cannot do. What are some of the books that you've particularly enjoyed in electronic form that you really think offered you something very valuable that you couldn't have gotten in a bound book?
Well, for example, I just saw a CD-ROM that was produced by a group in Rome of the Galleria Borghese, the collection there, and you can click on individual paintings, you can get their history, you can get their provenance, you can see other works by the same painter, you can arrange them as you like, you can do close-ups of them and look at details, you can get background on the technique, all of this stuff that would be just too complicated or dense for a print book, and probably would cost a lot more, actually, in a print book. And I think, in general, one of the most impressive things, at least about these CD-ROM products, is that where you're looking primarily at informational needs, things like encyclopedias and so on, and particularly where multimedia is involved, music or art or images, they really offer a lot more than the printed book does. And I think a certain portion of that kind of publishing will just migrate to electronic form.
I wonder how you feel about reading things that are hyperlinked. In other words, instead of reading in a linear form, there are highlighted words as you read, and those highlighted words connect you to writing on a related subject. So you can just find yourself taking all these tangents and actually never getting back to the main text.
Right. I love that. I mean, I think everybody's had that experience and loves just kind of wandering around there. There are these metaphors that people use, particularly in the American context of surfing or riding on the highway and so on, as if you had this great vista in front of you. But actually, I think it's a lot more like wandering around Venice in the fog. You walk down this street and that street and down this canal and so on and so forth. And after 3 minutes, you have no idea where you are, how you got there, what you're going to come on next. But that's the charm of it, and it is a real charm. If you're trying to get somewhere, if you want to stay on one route, if you are trying to get through an extended argument or narrative, it's a lot easier to do it in a paper book with covers that sort of separate this text from the rest of the world.
Do you read magazines online? Have you tried that yet?
I've looked at some of them. There are two kinds of things. On the one hand, there are things like Slate that Michael Kinsley's doing over at Microsoft and other things like that that basically try to move the traditional forms of print online. And they're interesting, but I think the limitations of the medium become very evident there. It's much easier to read a long article in the New Republic than a dozen screenfuls of material online. On the other hand, I think some of the most interesting things that you come online on the web in particular are these goofy little zines and sites and so on that are trying to do novel things that really don't have any print equivalents and that involve a different kind of writing. It's briefer, it's perkier, it's disconnected just as the medium is. And there's some very interesting things going on out there. I mean, you look at these sites like Suck.com and Blasthouse and The Onion and Word.com and so on. There are dozens of these things, and it's a young man's game. I mean, it's like trying to follow alternative music or something.
My guest is linguist Jeff Nunberg. He's edited a new book called The Future of the Book. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with linguist and Fresh Air commentator Jeff Nunberg. He's edited a new book of essays called The Future of the Book. You're a linguist, Jeff, so do you think that the internet and email are changing the way that people write when they communicate with each other?
Well, for one thing, I think they're making people write a lot more. There are millions of people in America who are writing letters for the first time in their lives, and maybe for the first time in 4 or 5 generations since telephones were first installed, people are suddenly using mail as a medium, and they're almost having to reinvent an epistolary form, a form that will work for letters. So it's breathless, it's often uncapitalized, you write very fast, as fast as you type, and you never put any punctuation marks, you don't put any capital letters, and it runs down the page, and it's all disconnected and so on and so forth, the way I'm talking now. But it's also very interesting, and it could be that out of that new form, which is somehow poised between conversation and real writing, something more interesting by way of a new kind of voice could emerge. I mean, in my more optimistic moods, I like to think that anyway.
And in the pessimistic moods?
In my pessimistic moods, I think it's just a sea of garbage.
Do you really?
No, there's an awful lot of dreck out there. And I suppose it's natural. People talk about the library without walls, and the part that they never say is when you tear down the walls, you're going to get all the street people coming in and putting their feet up on the desk in the reading room. So there's a lot of garbage out there, and it's very difficult to find interesting stuff. And the technologies we have available for search now, don't make it very easy. They make it, it's easy just simply to wander around. It's easy to go to a site if you know exactly where you're trying to go, but anything in between is enormously difficult. There's nothing like the experience of walking into a fairly well-organized bookstore and being able to look for what you want and pull it down.
You think that in the future we'll continue to have lots of books, but we'll also have lots of online publications and CD-ROMs. How do you think this is going to change the future of the library?
Well, there's for sure a lot of people who think that the brick-and-mortar library is going to go the way of the public bathhouse and will disappear soon. And unfortunately, there are people who are actually using this kind of argument as a justification for not building new libraries, for cutting budgets for library maintenance, for not buying more books for libraries, and so on. There was an ad for one of the computer companies on a while ago that showed a fellow in Tuscany, and he's explaining in Italian with subtitles how he's just finished his PhD at the University of Indiana, and he did this because the entire University of Indiana library was online, and it gave people to believe that that was actually a reality or near a reality. And when somebody went to the University of Indiana and said, well, what have you actually got online? It turned out that all they had was a bunch of works from their music library in a kind of experimental program. And there is this sense that, well, it's only a matter of time before all of this becomes electronically available. And I think it's a mistake. I think libraries serve an important function, that the organization of books on a shelves in this physical way is a very useful way to look through them. They're very important as just as physical gathering places. And one of the interesting things is that how many really nice new library buildings are being built, not simply to accommodate the new technology, but to enable people to meet around it. You've got the new Library of Technology on 34th Street in New York. We've got a wonderful library out in San Francisco that just opened. And these physical public spaces around books are very important, and I think will endure, well, forever.
Your new anthology that you edited, The Future of the Book, is published in book form, paper form, covers, the whole traditional book.
The whole 6 yards, yeah.
Yeah. Now, will that book also be online, and are you making a statement by the way that you're offering the book?
No. We produced it as a print book. I should make an effort to get it online, and University of California Press should make an effort to get it online. We may try to do that. This is something that's happening increasingly now, that publishers are making books available in more than one form. There are difficulties because nobody's quite sure how to charge for these things or how to get paid or how to protect the rights and prevent the book from the text from being circulated all around. But my sense is that this will be an increasing mode of publication. If we haven't done it with this book, it's just because I never got it together.
Well, but that that lack of initiative will help ensure the future of the book, I suppose.
I expect so, yeah, particularly if it's going to be the authors who are responsible to do the electronic versions and the publisher will take care of doing the print versions for you.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff Nunberg, thanks a lot for talking with us about the future of the book.
Well, thanks for having me.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist and Fresh Air commentator. He's a professor of linguistics at Stanford and a research scientist at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. He edited the new book, The Future of the Book. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We've got something special to look forward to next week, an interview with B.B. King. We'll close today's show with his 1969 recording, The Thrill Is Gone.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.